This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 29th of March 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live on Monocle 24. I'm Christian Yeo. Coming up, TV stations go off air and flights are grounded in Spain as thousands of workers go on strike in anger over labour reforms. I speak to Frankfurt's new mayor, Peter Feldman, about his Jewish upbringing and the challenges facing the city today. And Sweden's defence minister resigns amid intense media scrutiny over his dealings with Saudi Arabia. We'll also be looking at some of the quirky book titles which have made it to the final stage of the Bookseller's Novelty Annual Prize. All to come in the next hour on Midori House with me, Christian Yeo. But before that, let's get the news from around the world with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Arab leaders have dropped a demand that Bashar al-Assad give up the presidency of Syria, but urged him to act quickly on a UN-backed peace plan he has accepted as fighting between Syrian troops and rebels killed at least 22 people today. Arab League Secretary-General Nabil al-Arabi told Arab heads of state at a summit meeting in Baghdad, the solution for the crisis is still in the hands of the Syrians as a government and opposition. The UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon kept up pressure on Assad, saying he must turn his acceptance of the six-point peace plan into action to shift his country off what he called a dangerous trajectory with risks for the entire region.
It is essential that President Assad put those commitments into immediate effect. The world is waiting for commitments to be translated into action. The key here is implementation.
In Istanbul, Syrian opposition representatives met to try to settle deep internal disputes before the arrival of Western foreign ministers for a Friends of Syria conference on Sunday to map out where the year-old uprising is heading. The body of the al-Qaeda-inspired gunman who killed seven people in France this month has remained unburied after both Algeria and the city where the shootings took place, Toulouse, refused to allow the ceremony to be carried out on their turf. Mohamed Merah, a Frenchman of Algerian origin, who was shot dead by police last week following a siege at his home in Toulouse, was set to be buried in the North African country at the request of his father, who lives there. However, a senior French Muslim official said the mayor of the Algerian village of Bezaz had declined the request for security reasons. The World Bank President Robert Zoellick has said that plans to form a joint development bank by the BRICS group of the world's most powerful emerging economies may have a hard time getting off the ground and would struggle to match the World Bank's expertise. Zoellick, who is touring India's eastern coastal state of Orissa, deflected criticism that the organization has been dominated by the United States.
So I think part of this, personally, as an American who's worked with multilateral organizations, is it's good for Americans to have a chance to run some of them. Whether it's the World Bank or others, that's a whole different question. And I think they should try to select the best person. And fortunately, we've got three good candidates.
The Swedish Defence Minister Sten Tolfors has resigned after facing criticism over plans to build a weapons plant in Saudi Arabia. A spokesperson said he'd resigned at his own request. Confidential plans for the country's defence research agency to help Riyadh build weapons, including missiles and torpedoes, were revealed this month. Jets carrying West African presidents for a meeting with Mali's new military leaders were forced to turn back mid-flight today after hundreds of supporters of last week's coup invaded Bamako's main runway. An official from the regional bloc ECOWAS said the meeting, aimed at pressuring coup leaders to swiftly restore constitutional rule after they ousted President Amadou Toumani Touré, could be rescheduled for tomorrow if security allowed. Britain isn't convinced the Afghan government is giving the fight against corruption the priority it should. After a decade of war and billions of dollars in aid, corruption in Afghanistan is rampant and violence is spreading into once peaceful areas as Western forces begin to draw down most combat troops ahead of the 2014 pullout. Foreign Office Minister Alistair Burt is in the Afghan capital, where he was at an Olympic promotion event.
Everything that the Afghan people desire for Afghanistan in terms of stability and security depends on having confidence that the state can deliver not just security but all sorts of other services, and that it will be an open and fair society in which corruption, if not eliminated, needs to be much diminished.
And it's been warm here in London, and high temperatures in Paris, coupled with very little wind, have led to increased levels of dangerous PM10 particles in the atmosphere. The fine PM10 particles, which pose a particular health risk, are produced by industrial activity and by road traffic. In view of this, Parisian authorities have advised motorists to lower their speed by 20 kilometres an hour on the city's main routes. Those are the top stories on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much for that, Nick. Now, looking at the front pages, starting in Australia with the Sydney Morning Herald, and there's a crackdown on job claim rorts, according to the Herald, after an investigation by the Herald revealed rampant abuse of a welfare-to-work programme, which is costing the state $4.7 billion. Rampant abuse, and senior industry figures had known about the problem of abuse for more than a decade. Also, an electricity agency, Transgrid, has admitted that contractors did spray herbicides on vast swathes of wilderness in Australia's national parks. And an interesting story about new cruise ships that are due to plan their new routes. Sydney risks being dropped from the itineraries of a new wave of liners under construction of a report which said there's no room for them to dock at Garden Island Naval Base. And another one, third tragedy spurs safety questions. This is Kurrawa Beach, saying it can be a very dangerous one, as a 14-year-old boy was found dead after going missing on Wednesday. His body was found just over a kilometre away from where he went missing, and there's a harrowing picture of the search operation on the shoreline there. Looking at the New Zealand Herald, and Prime Minister John Key is denying reports that he was part of a group who backed Bronwyn Pullar's bid for a $14 million insurance payout. And there are also quotes from other senior National Party figures who've been dragged into this affair, including Wayne Mapp, who said, "I simply facilitated meetings. They ultimately led to a settlement." And also a large picture of Sir John Walker, a councillor in Auckland, who says, "I don't like my wife being threatened." And this is about him, along with another council member, accusing an opposition veteran protester, Marx Jones, of demanding that they sign a vote of no confidence for the Port of Auckland's management, threatening phone calls through the night, according to this gentleman, Sir John Walker, who the Herald says is a 1500-metre gold medalist who won at the Montreal Olympics in 1976. And there's a picture of him making his victorious run there, just in the background of his photo. And looking at the press as well, there's a very large bit of charged breakthrough in the Manning case. And this is the family of Mallory Manning, who say they finally got answers after the arrest of a 24-year-old man in relation to her murder. Those are the front pages in New Zealand and Australia. Let's get the world weather now with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
In Europe, we've been enjoying some amazing weather these past few days, but it is slowly changing. Here in the UK, temperatures will be dropping significantly over the next few days. It's already cooler in Germany. Eastern Europe may even get some winter weather over the weekend, but for the moment, the best weather is around the Mediterranean, Spain, France, and the Alps. Here's Friday's City Outlook. In London, 18 degrees and sunny. In Frankfurt, 12 degrees, fairly overcast. Vienna, 11 with sun and showers. And in Milan, it's still very warm, 23 degrees with sunshine. North America now, and across the US, currently we have typical early spring weather. The end of the week and into the weekend across the Midwest and the Eastern Seaboard is a mix of sunshine and some passing rain. Across southern Quebec and Ontario, more or less the same, but cooler, of course, in Canada. Here's Friday's City Outlook. Ottawa, plus 3 degrees, partly cloudy. In Boston, it's 9 with sun and a shower chance. New York City, 12 degrees with sunshine. And in Atlanta, a warm 25, but some thunderstorms here. Other world locations now. Rio de Janeiro, it's sunshine with thunderstorms. Highs of around 26 degrees and no real change for the next 2 to 3 days. Santiago, well, it's not a cloud in the sky. Temperatures of around 29. How about further north in the tropics in Caracas? About 30 here with sun and clouds. And finally in Cape Town, a good chance of rain during Thursday and Friday. And it's pretty cool, around 18 degrees. That's all from the Weather Desk. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Tom Ash. 1809 here in London, 6:09 a.m. if you're waking up in Auckland. You're listening to Midori House. We're back in just a moment.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 highlight, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ei oo.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojala version.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Now we begin in Frankfurt, where on Sunday the city elected its first Jewish mayor since the Holocaust. Frankfurt has a long-standing relationship with Israel, notably Tel Aviv. Peter Feldman, an economist by profession and social democrat, enjoyed a 15-point victory over his CDU rival Boris Rhein. He joins me on the line now. Peter Feldman, welcome to Midori House.
Yeah, hello.
Peter, first question. It's quite a grim title that the media has penned for you as Frankfurt's first Jewish mayor since the Holocaust. It's a well-intentioned label, but how do you feel about it?
I think I was not elected because I'm Jewish. I'm Jew, but in the election campaign, this didn't play any role. And I'm living very secular. I was grown up secular, so the main point in this election was how we deal with poor children, what we're going to do with the elderly people that are poor, how to get fast new flats, because we have a big deficit on flats, and what we're going to do on the internationalism of the city, which is an economic mega power that we didn't care about in the last years.
Mm. Go over some of the past relationships between Frankfurt and Tel Aviv in particular.
Yeah, we had very, very often a close relationship. And all the mayors always had a very good relation to Tel Aviv. And we had a lot of exchange, youth exchange, economic exchange, scientific exchange. So it was a very, very strong partnership, and this will be continue, and I want to strengthen it, especially in the time of war, like in the time when Iraq sends guts against Tel Aviv. Our old mayor was sitting in the bunkers in Tel Aviv. So it's a very nice tradition.
Is it fair to say Frankfurt might be the Jewish heartland of Germany?
No, really.
It had quite a large population, didn't it?
We have a big Jewish community. Mm. But as I told you, in this election campaign, it didn't play a role if someone is Jewish or not Jewish. Right? Yeah. If people wanted someone... Who has a good feeling for their situation, and where they have the feeling that they want a mayor who always was a long time living in a poor neighborhood. So there should be a guy in the front who knows what's going on and where the problems are.
So really, your faith only came into the public's attention after your victory. How do you feel about that?
The German media is not that big story. It's a big story in the Israeli media and international media, because in Frankfurt, nobody really cares about it. Mm. So do I.
So looking at what was part of the election campaign for you and your rivals, it was very much economic problems, wasn't it? There's a housing crisis in Frankfurt. And you say your upbringing helped in your success with that. Describe your upbringing.
A poor neighborhood. My family was always quite intellectual, but we were always living in a poor neighborhood. So people wanted to that there's someone in sitting on the head of the city who really cares about things like children's poverty, education, isolation of elderly people. And I was the head of a youth center in the north of Frankfurt. I was head of a house for elderly people. And I was also very active in activities for more flats. So they said we want someone who really cares about the feeling, what we want. And so I was close with the feelings, and I will be active in these topics if I'm elected or not elected. And so everybody has the feeling it's something authentic. I will continue in these fights on these topics, and but now more easy because I'm doing it top down.
Hmm. In your work as an economist, do you think that helps you now in moving forward with Frankfurt and addressing some of the problems in Frankfurt economically? You're well placed to do that, surely.
I studied politics and I studied also economy, so I know how to play and to work with numbers. So it could help, because I think we need together in Frankfurt people that earn money and want to make good money, and the people that are caring about the social consistency of the city. Frankfurt was always a city where many people were active for poor people and care about each other. And the people, the rich and the poor, always were in the tradition to take responsibility. And this is the tradition that I want to keep and to develop.
Well, I wish you all the best on your term now. I'm sure it'll be celebrated by both the Social Democrats and the Jewish community as well.
This can be.
That was Mayor of Frankfurt, Peter Feldman. You're listening to Midori House. We're back in a second.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle also has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop-in-shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop, carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
The Menu is Monocle's delectable food and drinks program with me, Markus Hippi. On the menu, you'll find out about delicious edibles and mouth-watering drinks. We traverse the globe in search of the pioneers, making a stir amongst the food connoisseurs. We hunt down the wonderful and sometimes weird tasty trends that are making a buzz in the food industry.
We've been sort of traveling and collecting stories and collecting projects. So one of the things we hope to do is to connect all these narratives across these different geographies.
Milan to Tokyo, Buenos Aires to Auckland. Each week we send our correspondents to the far-flung corners of the world. We pop into independent bakeries, butchers and wineries to find people passionate about what they make. From French cheese to Bulgarian wine, from Japanese chocolates to South African caterpillar snacks. The Menu premieres every Friday at 1900 hours GMT. Join us for a drink where everything is on the menu.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
I think it's time for some music now. This is Record Collector by Lissy.
Saying that I won't get lost ever again. Who knows? And I know yesterday's rain.
That was Record Collector by Lissy. You're listening to Midori House. Now we head to Sweden, where the country's defence minister has stepped down. Sten Tolgfors blamed his departure on the pressure he'd faced from Swedish media over leaked plans to build a weapons plant in Saudi Arabia. He denied any wrongdoing and insisted the plans were consistent with an existing military agreement between the two countries. Well, joining me now is Mikael Holmström, security policy correspondent at Svenska Dagbladet. Mikael, firstly, why is Tolgfors resigning now? What were the events that led up to him quitting?
Well, actually, what he said himself, it was the pressure around all this, the media coverage about Saudi, the weapons factory that should be built in Saudi Arabia.
He'd been planning to leave for some time, though, hadn't he? How bad did things get in the public spotlight for him to walk away so quickly?
Well, actually, it was a bit surprised that he decided to resign today. No one really expected that he would leave so soon. So maybe something is coming up which we don't know about yet. So to prevent something that's coming up, he decided to resign.
For those who aren't aware of this plant in Saudi Arabia, what is the relationship between Sweden and Saudi Arabia on this?
Well, actually, there was an agreement in 2005 by the social democratic government to have cooperation with Saudi Arabia, which were buying a lot of Swedish weapons and weapon systems. And the Saudis, they had old anti-tank weapons, which they wanted to renovate because they were getting old. And they asked Sweden to supply them with a factory to produce these anti-tank weapons, the ammunition for the anti-tank weapons. And then the Swedish government got cold feet and didn't really want to do this, and that there was a government agency which put up a front company to carry it out in a way, and there was a lot of confusion. The whole debate now is who knew what and who decided what and so on. And where was the responsibility?
Togfors has been accused of being underhand in his role in this. Is that a legitimate accusation?
What would you mean with that?
That not everything has been out in the open, and there's a lot of public bad feeling about what this means for Sweden's neutrality, because it's known around the world for being neutral, and it doesn't bode well in that. Would this affect it?
Well, I don't think everything comes out when it comes to weapons and arms export in any country. But and when it comes to neutrality, Sweden has given up that. I mean, we're very actively working together with NATO. We took part in for example, air campaign against the Libyan regime. Even if it was only reconnaissance planes, we at least took part in that, which was more than a lot of NATO countries did. But this is, of course, a question of public confidence in the government and whether we were misled or not, the public.
And was the press right to arguably hound him in this way and force his resignation?
Well, I don't think actually that the press forced him, the media forced him. It was that he decided that this was enough and couldn't stand it anymore. But we don't know if, you know, one investigation is going to be started by the parliament, then there's a prosecutor looking into what happened on this agency, because the agency started this front company, but it's unclear where came the money from. Some money was provided by the Swedish military intelligence, but that was just a loan, and they got the money back, and they say they didn't really know that it was going to be used for a front company. And all the time there has been ministry officials dealing with this, and the question is how much was the ministry involved and the minister, how much did he know? So there's a lot of unclear details which we don't know today.
And from what you're saying, it sounds like these questions won't go away now that Sten has left the role. How damaging do you think this is to the wider government?
That depends what the media and the investigations will find out. I mean, it's hard to say, but all the time you have the feeling that they're hiding something, but we don't know exactly what it is.
Okay, well, I'll leave it there. Thank you for your time. That was Mikael Holmström, the security policy correspondent at Svenska Dagbladet. You're listening to Midori House. Stay with us. We'll have the news headlines shortly.
LDN TYO. NYC MTV.
Now, in the next half hour on Midori House, we'll be heading to Madrid to discuss the Spanish strikes. And we'll also hear about an award for the oddest book title. But first, here's Nick Kelly with the news headlines.
Thanks, Christian. Arab leaders have dropped a demand that Bashar al-Assad give up the presidency of Syria, but urged him to act quickly on a UN-backed peace plan he has accepted as fighting between Syrian troops and rebels killed at least 22 people today. The body of the al-Qaeda-inspired gunman who killed 7 people in France this month has remained unburied after both Algeria and the city where the shootings took place, Toulouse, refused to allow the ceremony to be carried out on their turf. World Bank President Robert Zoellick has said that plans to form a joint development bank by the BRICS group of the world's most powerful emerging economies may have a hard time getting off the ground and would struggle to match the World Bank's expertise. The Swedish Defence Minister Sten Tolgfors has resigned after facing criticism over plans to build a weapons plant in Saudi Arabia. Jets carrying West African presidents for a meeting with Mali's new military leaders were forced to turn back mid-flight today after hundreds of supporters of last week's coup invaded Bamako's main runway. Spanish workers slowed public transport to a crawl and disrupted factories today in a protest over Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy's sweeping reforms a day before a new round of budget cuts. Police fired water cannon and tear gas at a crowd of several thousand demonstrators protesting for a second day in the Turkish capital Istanbul today against an education bill which secular parties say is designed to promote Islamic schooling. And high temperatures in Paris, coupled with very little wind, have led to increased levels of dangerous PM10 particles in the atmosphere, posing a health risk to residents, leading officials to advise motorists to lower their speed. Those are the top stories on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Nick. Now, Spanish unions have gone on strike today, as Nick was just saying in the news headlines, in protest at labour reforms pushed through by Parliament. Workers across the country observed the walkout. Regional TV stations in Andalusia, Madrid and Catalonia went off air. It brought about travel chaos on the roads, rails and on Spain's major air routes as well. Fighting broke out between protesters and police outside Madrid's bus garage. And those who've walked out are warning that more strike action could be around the corner unless the government doesn't make amendments to its plans by May the 1st. But with the highest rate of unemployment in the EU, Spain's under pressure to reduce its budget deficit. Joining me on the line is Monocle correspondent Liam Aldous, who's in Madrid for us. Liam, how are you?
Oh, I'm all struck out. How are you?
Have you been out on the streets today, capturing the public's views?
Well, I'm actually not in Madrid. I'm prevented from going back to Madrid. I'm in the south of Spain. I've been in three cities today, actually, trying to gradually make my way up. We hired a car to get back to Madrid, but now we're stuck in Córdoba. And I've seen three different cities and the action of the strike there. It's been quite interesting. But in the south, it's been some of the most violent protests have been in Sevilla, but we kind of bypassed Sevilla. I was in Cádiz, and now I'm in Córdoba. But it's been quite interesting. The images on the news are of burning bins and people attacking the stock market in Barcelona. But in general, people have been quite well behaved. So don't let the images on the visual images fool you.
They are around the world. Media outlets are portraying this as quite a dramatic day for Spain. And there's speculation it's going in the same direction as Greece. But from what you're saying, it's not likely anytime soon.
That's a logical conclusion. But Spanish protesters do have a reputation for behaving quite well. I mean, the precursor to the Occupy movement was the 15M movement, or the 15M movement last year. And that set a precedent for quite well-behaved protests. So, I mean, there may be more protests to come, and they could get more violent, depending on whether the government does come to the negotiating table. But I don't think it will turn to Greece. I'm hoping it won't anyway.
I'm sure. As it currently stands, what are these reforms likely to do?
Well, they're all aimed at trying to make Spain more competitive. I mean, Spain has some of the most rigid labour rules and laws in Europe. And the newly elected government is trying to make Spain more flexible and more attractive for employers to invest here or employ people. But to do that, they've actually made it more easier for employers to fire people. So this is kind of the double-edged sword. But in general, basically what they've proposed to do is cut severance pay from 45 days to 33 days and basically make it easier to fire people on the basis of productivity. So in the scheme of things, it's kind of a good thing. But, I mean, a lot of the commentary from the protests has been that we've fought for generations to achieve these rights, and in just the swift stroke of a pen, the government is taking them away.
Is there any sort of voice from the other side of the argument, business leaders, for instance?
Well, businesses have been quiet, probably. They don't want to attract the furor from the protesters, which has been another interesting element, actually. I mean, I was quite surprised all day. I've just seen mobs roaming through the city, targeting businesses that have stayed open. And a lot of businesses, particularly in service industries like cafes and restaurants, have closed their roller shutters halfway and turned the lights off, but are still serving people. And if a union mob does come by, they quickly close up just so they don't get a mob surrounding their business. I mean, we tried to get breakfast this morning at one of the main supermarkets in Carrefour, and it was the roller door was half open, and we got a breakfast. But then soon after, a mob came and they closed up shop immediately. So it's a very interesting element with the Spanish strike, actually.
And that isn't likely to go in a good direction, is it? Like preying on fear, essentially. And it's not likely to get people on their side of things and support their argument, surely.
Well, it is indicative of how much power the unions still have in Spain. I mean, if they can muster big crowds and target businesses that don't want to strike, then that is worrying. But we'll just have to see what happens. I mean, the government is standing firm. They've said that at the end of the day, they're not going to change the basic elements of the legislation. They are open to negotiate with the other parties and enrich the text of the law, as they put it. But it doesn't look like they're going to move. I mean, the unions have given them that deadline until the 1st of May to make some changes, but it doesn't look like they're going to do things. I mean, today the employment minister received a standing ovation in the parliament. The president himself is actually out of Spain. He's still in Seoul attending the nuclear conference. And the king is also out of the country as well. I mean, he's in Bosnia, which is actually breaking tradition. Usually if there's a general strike, the king stays out of work. So it's quite interesting. The government's surging ahead with work, but there hasn't been any picket lines to try and prevent them from working as yet.
And they look to be standing firm on their policy.
Yes, they've said they're not going to change. I mean, they're newly elected, so they're still trying to get all these tough reforms in the first days. I mean, Rajoy, the president, said that he's one of the most reforming governments in the first 100 days. He's brought in so many reforms. And tomorrow they're actually going to announce huge budget cuts as well. So, I mean, it's all, when it rains, it pours in Spain, I guess. They're apparently going to cut 15% from every government ministry, and tens of billions of dollars, apparently. So, I mean, there could be a lot more protests. So, I guess stay tuned to the, if you're travelling to Spain, because it could affect you just like it affected me.
Absolutely. I do hope you get back to Madrid eventually. You are our man on the ground there. The sense of unemployment or a cloud above people's heads and the future of their jobs, you know, turning down this or demanding that this reform be scrapped is likely to make the prospect of unemployment even greater. And it's got, you know, currently a dubious title of having the highest rate of unemployment in the EU. Even the people, those who are unemployed and jobless, surely they're in support of these reforms.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, there's a lot of people that are unemployed, so there's a great scope of opinion, but I mean, the government itself is saying they want to modernise Spain, so it's going to be tough. They're trying to get these reforms through in the beginning of their term, so hopefully it will bear some fruit in the long run. But I mean, it's a big problem. I mean, it could only get worse, I guess.
Liam, thank you for that. That was Monocle's correspondent, Liam Aldous. You're listening to Midori House.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 è io che so.
Tema on
Monocle
24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back. Now, auctioneers in Europe are reoffering high-value items for sale after Chinese bidders failed to pay. It was the latest sign of auction houses clamping down on slow payments and non-payments. It's been a long-running saga since 2009 when the Chinese bidder refused to pay for Yves Saint Laurent-owned artefacts. And Sotheby's introduced a requirement last April that bidders on premium lots must pay a deposit of $1 million Hong Kong dollars. Now we have art market editor-at-large for the art newspaper, Georgina Adam, on the line to talk about this. Georgina, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you very much.
How bad is the situation with non-payment for purchases in auction houses?
Well, I think it's got worse, and it's got worse with the arrival of mainland Chinese bidders on the market. There's no doubt, as you say, the landmark case was the Zodiac heads in the Yves Saint Laurent sale. And as more Chinese, particularly mainland bidders, it's not a problem with Hong Kong buyers, but particularly as more mainland Chinese enter the auction houses and bid, unfortunately they don't always pay.
And why not?
I think it's something, it's cultural. You know, for a start, they were brought up, most of them, under a communist system, and it's a pretty unreliable sort of system in China, in mainland China. You know, there's still a lot of corruption. And I think that they are not used to our norms of doing business.
So they don't essentially honour the verbal contract, as it were, inside an auction house?
No, I don't think that they see that they should have to.
Will they have to change, or will auction houses have to change in light of that?
Auction houses have changed already in the sense that they're now making these premium, they call premium bids, which is that you have to pay a deposit. Of course, the other famous case of non-buying is that £51.4 million vase that was sold at Bainbridge's in Essex in 2011, which has never been paid for.
And that was heralded as one of the most expensive purchases, was it not?
Absolutely. It was an enormous price to be paid. There were 8 bidders on it. So, you know, it was not just 2 people pushing it right up.
How long can it take now? How long does it take for a seller to then, you know, relist their item if there's failure to pay? How long do they have to wait before they can find another buyer?
Well, there's not a contractual length of time. Well, there is a contractual in the sense they're supposed to pay in a certain amount of time. But obviously the auction houses try to exhaust every other avenue before they finally lose patience and decide to reoffer it, because obviously it's going to sell for less. And it's not a question of saying, well, the person who underbid the successful bidder will buy it at that price, because he could argue he wouldn't have gone that high if the other chap hadn't been bidding. So you're actually sort of starting from zero again.
I mean, aside from having a deposit put in place, what else could be done to, you know, deter people from reneging on these deals?
Well, not very much, quite frankly. I think that having a deposit is the best solution, really.
Have there been any other high-profile cases of this happening in the past, aside from the vase and the Yves Saint Laurent artefacts?
Well, of course, this has happened. In America, there's been a long-running case that's opposed a property developer called Halsey Miner, and he didn't pay for things, and that went to court. And of course, there are more cases in which it doesn't go to court, because the auction houses are not very keen on publicising the fact that people bid on something and then don't pay for it. So if possible, they try to avoid legal action, which makes it public.
And I mean, is there any resistance from people who are now being asked to pay these deposits?
That's something that is really kept quite confidential.
Ah.
I don't think the auction houses, you know, there's a great culture of confidentiality in the auction houses, and I'm certain they're certainly not about to advertise who does or doesn't refuse. There are, though, in the auction world, people who are called non-bids. There are some people who, even if they bid, because they've been bad payers in the past, the auctioneer just doesn't take their bid.
We must leave it there. Georgina, thank you so much for your insight there. Georgina Adam, the art market editor for the Art Newspaper. You're listening to Midori House. Stay with us.
The Globalist bids good night to America, good morning to Europe, and good afternoon to Asia, with 2 hours of analysis, paper reviews, and a run-through of the topical stories shaping the world wherever you are.
There's a lot of money in this country. It's a very strong economy, and it's really growing rapidly, and so it's the natural choice.
Wake up in Europe to The Globalist, live every weekday at 6 a.m. London time, here on Monocle 24.
The April issue of Monocle is something of a vote winner, as we look at the power of parliaments from Europe's high north Sami HQ to Addis Ababa's new gathering place for the African Union. We also limber up for our Olympic series as we head out on the Tigris with Iraq's rowing team. Then there's a look at doing business in Wellington and a frothy soap story from Portugal. And our editors have lots more to offer too.
In the design section, it's hammer time as we take a look at the world of design auctions. We'll also visit the young creative set, breathing new life into ancient Kyoto. And we drop in on the LA home of Dion Neutra, a perfectly preserved residence designed together with his late father, Richard Neutra.
In the edit section, we take you inside Portugal's oldest soap producers after selecting the best grapes from a winery in Mendoza. And prepare for a smooth landing with our piece on Maldivian seaplanes.
There are also recipes for a cosy dinner and recipes for business success courtesy of a Paris meets New York publisher. The April issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Let's have a song now. This is Pharaohs by Subtract. That was Pharaohs by Subtract. You're listening to Midori House. Now, a guide to Estonian socks, an examination of the role of the mushroom in Christian art, and a celebration of the humble office chair are amongst the books in contention for the Diagram Prize for Oddest Book Title of the Year. The prize has been handed out by trade publication The Bookseller every year since 1978, in celebration of the oddities of the literary world. Joining me on the line now is Philip Stone, the charts editor for The Bookseller. How are you, Philip?
I'm all right, thank you.
Firstly, it sounds like quite a fun job you have there, deciding this.
It is. It's the highlight of my year, actually. I mean, normally week on week, I'm just analysing the book market. So I'm looking at print book sales and its effects on how booksellers are doing and the impact of e-books. So looking at books with odd titles is a highlight, certainly.
And what's caught your eye this year?
Well, I think it was a very, very good year for odd title books. I must admit, I was a bit nervous because obviously the global economy is a little bit weak at the moment. So I thought, well, publishers might be holding back a bit and not investing in these kind of niche and imaginative books. But they have been. I think this year has been one of the kind of closest, but also certainly the most interesting battles. There were, you know, quite a few good books out there that didn't make it onto the list as well. But of those that did, I mean, my personal favourite is probably Estonian Sock Patterns All Around the World. Because that was actually a sequel to a book called Estonian Mitten Patterns.
Oh, really?
It was.
So in light of demand, they came out with another one.
Exactly, yeah. And it sounds like I'm making it up, but I'm really not. That's actually the case.
And these are serious books, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Yeah. I mean, they might not sell in the hundreds and thousands, but they are deeply serious works by some people who are obviously incredibly passionate about Estonian socks and mushrooms in Christian art, yeah.
Absolutely. But you say, you know, you might expect publishers to be more serious now, not taking as many risks, but do you think in the current climate maybe people need more of a laugh and these sorts of book titles might strike a chord with readers?
Yeah, exactly. And I think our winner this year is the potential to if it gets backing by bookshops and kind of international publishers who might snap up rights, then I think it has the potential to kind of crack the bestsellers because it is a quirky title that I can see, you know, filling Christmas stockings and being wrapped up for Mother's Day and Father's Day and Valentine's Day and all sorts of other gift days. So, yeah.
Are publishers becoming more imaginative, you think, as time goes on?
I think quite a lot of diversifying, yeah. And I think they're trying to kind of unearth hidden gems. And I think around gift season, that's particularly the case. Especially kind of in the kind of humour and the kind of quirky meanings of words and, you know, kind of like slight interesting, quirky, maybe a little bit of humour thrown in there as well. I mean, those books can potentially be huge bestsellers for publishers and can kind of make or break their year, really. And the same for bookshops as well. So I think publishers are always on the lookout for imaginative and interesting publications, certainly.
Just looking at the past winners, and feel free to bring up a few of your own, but a lot of them, or at least a couple of these ones I see, were off the back of not real books, because these books are real as well, but successful books that were well known in the public domain. You had these then novelty books that came off the back of them. First, in 1980, you chose The Joy of Chickens. I assume that's a nod to The Joy of Sex. And then in 1997, there was The Joy of Sex, the Pocket Edition.
Yeah, quite. The 97 winner of the Pocket Edition was that's just fantastic. I mean, that leads to all sorts of ideas in the mind, which perhaps one shouldn't really go there. But yeah, I think a deserving winner that year, certainly.
Do you think a writer would like to have their their original title parodied in this way. It's a compliment in a way, isn't it?
It is a compliment, yeah. I mean, the best, some of the best-selling books have had satires written about them. Like Harry Potter has been done. I mean, there was a whole series of books called the Barry Trotter books, and The Hobbit's been done, and the Stephanie Meyer books as well. So, I mean, I think it's a sign of their success and popularity, and I think the authors of the original book should probably take it as a compliment that people are willing to kind of write spoofs of those bestsellers, yeah, certainly.
Are there any that cross the line? There are a few that dance along it this year. One I won't discuss, A Cooking Guide, but, you know, are there any titles that you really can't even consider?
To be honest, anything's open. I mean, we had like about 75 submissions this year, so we had to come up with a shortlist of seven somehow. We kind of strike out old titles. We like to include books that were published in 2000 or the year in which kind of we're celebrating. So this year's prize was all about books published in 2011. If they're too vulgar and crude, or we think that they're too obviously funny, we don't like to include them. We like a book to be kind of unintentionally odd. Mm. We like a book to have an unintentionally odd title, and because in theory, any self-publisher out there could just upload a book to, an ebook retailer and give it an odd title in the hope of winning this prize and giving themselves a few extra sales that they might not normally have had. But we're usually quite good at spotting those and kind of striking them out. But other than that, no, we'll take anything. As long as it's not too crude or particularly vulgar, then, we'll consider any title, because it's an international prize as well. We don't restrict it to any kind of one market either. So anything and everything to celebrate the oddity of books.
So it mustn't be forced, then?
No, we don't like a book to have a forced odd title.
A lot of these, though, have the potential to become viral hits, don't they, or a cult following just because of the title. But I've read here not many of these books are actually available online, which would be the prime arena for them to sell.
Yeah. I mean, that is the case, that some of them aren't easily accessible, I'd say. I mean, I think if you walked into your regular high street bookshop, you might be hard-pressed to find copies of them. But I mean, that could all change. If people start demanding enough of them, then hopefully that things will change for the publishers and the authors of these books.
Well, it's certainly more fun going into a shop and asking rather than searching online, I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely. If you can get a reaction out of the bookseller who doesn't know whether or not you're a joke customer and being filmed for some kind of comedy programme and they don't take you seriously, yeah, I think that's brilliant.
And when's the winner announced, Philip?
Well, the winner is announced first thing tomorrow morning.
Is there a celebration for the winner at all?
Well, we've contacted the publishers of the winner. They're based in Australia, so they're asleep at the moment, so they're going to wake up to find out that they've won a prestigious literary award.
Oh, you've given us a teaser there, I think. We must leave it there. Philip, thanks so much for that. That was Philip Stone, the charts editor for The Bookseller. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Let's have some music now. This is Asthma Attack by Cock and Ball Kid.
London, I love you, but you're bringing me down.
That was Asthma Attack by Cock and Ball Kit.
LDN TYO. NYC MT4.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of Midori House. The show was produced by Dawn Trump, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. The Monocle Daily will be back at 2200 hours London time. They'll be starting the day in Asia and asking if women take more risks as CEOs after a Bundesbank report. We've got the headlines with Nick Kelly next, and just after the news, we have The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck.